Okay, well, thank you everybody. Where today I'm going to talk about the sun and climate change, or our climate. Now, my wife would tell me this is very ill-advised, because to talk about the sun and the climate, to pack it all into one lecture is probably expecting a bit much, but I used to give a lecture on the sun, and then I thought, well, actually it's important that people who have some knowledge about some aspect of these things that relate to climate change jolly well ought to brief themselves and be prepared to talk to people like yourselves about these things. So I kind of modified it to talk about the sun and climate change, and I suppose the problem is to tell you all I know about the sun and all I know about climate change in an hour or so may not be the easiest thing to do. Now, it is possible that climate change may well be the most serious threat that humanity faces, and it could well be facing it in the next 100 years or so. But of course, the idea that the climate has been stationary is utterly false. The climate has changed a lot in the past. These trees flourished in dead flay and sausage flay for about 200 years, about 1,000 years ago, and then they died. And that may well have been partly to do with a warmer phase of climate in Namibia. Now, the problem can be very simply put. On the left, we have the mean temperatures for the world, which is a very difficult parameter to define. And on the right, we have the rising carbon dioxide. Now, there is no doubt that both these things are rising. Global temperature is rising, CO2 is rising, and there is no doubt that carbon dioxide is rising as a result of human activity. Now, the question is, to what extent is carbon dioxide causing the rise in world temperatures, and to what extent does the sun make a contribution? We know that humans have worshipped the sun since really the beginning of human consciousness and recognized that it is the source of life, and of course, ultimately, it's the sun that controls the entire climate of the world. And we need to do just a bit of very simple-minded, well, simple physics here, not quite so simple-minded physics, just to see just how it is that the sun affects the temperature of the Earth. Now, the sun is a body that radiates at a temperature of 5780 degrees, so it radiates most of its radiation at visible wavelengths. And the Earth has a certain diameter, so it intersects a very small amount of the radiation that comes from the sun. You can think of all the radiation filling a sphere, a small amount of it hits the Earth. It heats the Earth up, and we must be in an equilibrium situation where the Earth loses as much energy as it receives from the sun, and it does that by radiating that energy away. But it, of course, it is at a lower temperature, so it radiates at a longer wavelength. If the Earth was a perfect absorber, its equilibrium temperature, with no atmosphere, with nothing else, would be, there's the equilibrium temperature, 5 degrees centigrade.
But straight away, we make us an assumption about what technically in astronomy is known as albedo, but you could think of as the reflectivity of clouds on the surface of the Earth, that 30% of the radiation that strikes the Earth from the sun is immediately reflected back into space. So if we then do our equilibrium calculation for the sun and the Earth, so they loses as much radiation as it receives, the average temperature would come out to minus 18 degrees centigrade. And clearly, the Earth is a lot hotter than that. And that is due to what is called the greenhouse effect. But of course, like so many things that have definitions, the definition's completely wrong. The reason a greenhouse gets hot is nothing to do with the reason the Earth gets hot. It's to do with the fact that convection is prevented. You can't, the hot air just fills up the greenhouse and is trapped there. Okay, so this little illustration shows two cases. Here's the Earth with an atmosphere. Here's the Earth without an atmosphere. They both receive the same amount of radiation from the sun. 30% is reflected away, and 70% is re-emitted. And we've just seen the equilibrium temperature is minus 18 degrees. Now, what happens if we stick in an atmosphere? Well, the atmosphere, and particularly water vapor, and to some extent, of course, carbon dioxide, prevents the long radiation getting out. So what does the Earth do? It heats up and heats up until the tiny fraction, well, the fairly large fraction that does get out, exactly balances what comes in. And of course, the only way it can sort of, you know, force radiation through here is by making it really hot under here, so that the small amount that gets out is just the right amount to balance what comes in. Well, it's not a huge effect, but it is a fairly significant effect. This is the greenhouse effect. It means instead of being at minus 18 degrees centigrade, the Earth is on average at plus 14 centigrade. And that way, it can shove enough radiation through this blanketing atmosphere to balance what comes in. And that is what the greenhouse effect is all about. And I think it's quite important to know that. So, you know, if we put more greenhouse gases in here to act as a filter, then we have to raise this temperature to force our radiation through. Now, that is quite simple. Now, one of the strongest greenhouse gases is, in fact, water vapor. And, of course, we can, if we're not careful, but certainly it's possible that Venus had a runaway greenhouse effect, where, of course, the hotter this got, the more water vapor was evaporated, the more blanketing there was, the hotter it got, and so on and so forth, till all the water had been evaporated. And there's no water present on Venus today, but what is very interesting is that the probes that have been examining Venus have detected a sort of plasma gas leaving the surface of Venus that contains two parts of hydrogen and one part of oxygen, suggesting that it is still losing water into space. Okay, so that's the greenhouse effect. Now, what I want to do is to look at the effect of the sun on the Earth's climate. Now, yesterday we saw how the sun turns hydrogen into helium, slowly uses up the hydrogen in its core. Here's the core, and we're going to start talking about the sun itself, of course. So from the core, we transfer energy through radiation to near the surface, where we get a lot of convection going, and we'll look at this later. Now, the core is using up its hydrogen, turning it into helium. So helium we are increasing effectively the density of the core. So we're actually increasing the rate at which nuclear fusion reactions run. Now, so on the last 4,500 million years, that's the age of the solar system, the luminosity of the sun has increased by a massive 30%. Now, there's another way of expressing the situation. If everything is now happy as we are today, with the sun 30% more luminous than it was when it started, then if we were to extrapolate backwards, 2,000 million years ago, the Earth would have been just solid ice. But that was not the case. We seem to have had liquid water around since almost the beginning of the solar system. And that means that the Earth has had some way of compensating for that. And there is a lot of discussion about this, but that goes for much of what I will say today. But one of the ideas is that we have this CO2 thermostat, if you like. But it works on a very long time scale of about 200 million years. CO2 is released in volcanoes, it warms the atmosphere, it evaporates the sea, it produces clouds. Now, I should say that low-level clouds cool the Earth by reflecting radiation. High-level clouds trap radiation and warm the Earth. So even clouds can be contentious. Anyway, we evaporate water, we make clouds, we then have rain, and rain falls on land. It is dissolved carbon dioxide, so it is carbonic acid. It then leaches away the rocks and forms carbonates and things that then form sediments. And because the time scale for the ocean floor, there's no ocean floor that is much older than 200 million years. Ocean floor is subducted and then remelted. So here is a possible thermostat that has kept the Earth at the right temperature, kept liquid water on a time scale of 4,000 million years. Now, another thing about our Sun is it orbits our galaxy. And as it does, this is a picture of a galaxy like ours, it goes through spiral arms. And again, this is very contentious. And it is thought that there may well be, on a time scale of now, 500 million years, and don't be, this is a very complicated diagram, but the main thing is to see this thing going up and down here, which is some measure of past temperature. Blue bits are ice ages up here, so this is on the time scale of the present there, 500 million years ago, that it is thought that these periodicities of hot and cold spells may well be related to the orbit of the Earth and the Sun around our galaxy. So, we have this periodicity, 500 million years or so. Now, let's come to the latest, the last 50 million years. Now, during the last 50 million years, the Earth has been cooling. And the main cause of the Earth's cooling is to do with continental drift. And here we have 200 million years ago. Look at, this is India, 200 million years, 135 million years, 65 million years, and then about 50 million years, 54 million years, bang, it collides with Asia and raises the Himalayas. And what have the Himalayas been doing? They are being eroded. So we are living in a period of rapid erosion. So that means we are locking up carbon dioxide. So we're taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, and we have been doing so more or less for the last 54 million years. And the supporting evidence for that is this graph, India collides with Asia. This is an attempt to show how temperature has varied over the last, this is the present now, at this end, over the last 55, 60 million years or so. So in other words, we are down here, we are living in a relatively cold phase in the history of the world. And you will see there are axes that claim to have temperature on them, and there you will see things like oxygen 18, preliminary isotope ratios, and I'm just going to come to that in a minute. So it's important to realise what I think I'm showing you here is that there are all kinds of factors operating that are changing the world's climate, everything from orbiting the galaxy to the rearrangement of our continents, and of course that also results in the rearrangement of our oceans and ocean circulation, that are there. So climate has changed a lot in the past and would certainly change in the future whatever we are to do about it. Now, I have to mention parameters and proxies, and a lot of what I'm going to say in this lecture is not stuff that you must try and get down in notes, because there's far too much of it, but it's to give you a flavour of the sort of issues we have. Now, the real problem with this whole climate change thing is that simple parameters like temperature and CO2, we just haven't measured them for long enough. We've got temperature records, but not worldwide, say in the UK going back 240 years. We've been measuring atmospheric CO2 directly for about 50 years, but of course we can measure it pretty accurately for maybe half a million, maybe more years in ice cores. And the solar irradiance, that's the total amount of flux we get from the sun, for about 30 years. And then, you see, we run into problems. So we have direct measurements there, but so we have proxies. Now, isotope ratios that are found in seashells and ice core are proxies for temperature. In other words, they correlate with temperature. CO2 we can get in ice cores. Now, solar irradiance, we think sunspots, the number of sunspots is correlated with the total amount of energy coming from the sun. Where do we get it? Looking at the sun. So we have been measuring sunspots for about 400 years. Now, we also notice that sunspots are linked to cosmic rays, the cosmic ray flux at Earth. And so we can find, so they're linked to that, and so we can use those for a proxy for sunspots, and we've measured cosmic rays for 60 years, which gives us a tiny calibration, and we can
you know, perhaps measure, use isotope, anomalous isotope ratios as proxies for cosmic rays. Now, I show you all this because it is just to make you realize how very difficult it is to discuss climate change when ideally you need a nice long baseline and you have these problems. So don't sort of feel you've got to remember them. Okay, now, let us now look, we'll get back to our story, Earth climate on the scale of the last 3 million years. Now, during the last 3 million years, we have been dropping in and out of ice ages. This is quite interesting. So, essentially, let's go to the present here. This is where we are up here at the present. This, you see, we're talking about proxies. This is proxy, so this is hot, this is cold. And this was the height of the last ice age, 100,000 years before there was a warm period. So you can see we have been, the last 3 million years, dropping in and out of ice ages. And certainly, the chief scientist, Sir David King, in a lecture I attended, suggested, and you remember this is the bottom end of that general decline in temperature for the last 50 million years, that this behaviour of the last 3 million years may be a precursor to a major ice age. And it is quite interesting that back in the 70s, climate scientists worried about the onset of the next ice age. I mean, quite apart from a major ice age that might go on for 10 or 100 million years, we were sort of running out of steam at the peak. There was no reason to suppose that this peak would be any different from this one, or this one. Now, you will see that some interesting, you will see 100,000-year world, 41,000-year world. And incidentally, these red things are times when the Earth's magnetic field has flipped over. So something where the magnetic field is weakening at the moment, maybe we're due for a flip over. Now, what this means is that the characteristic frequency of these ice ages, you can see the ice ages at the bottom, is about every 41,000 years. Here, for some reason, it's increased to 100,000 years. Now, there was a Serbian mathematician in the last century who looked at these things and realized that these periodicities were reflected in the behaviour of the Earth's orbit. And they were referred to as Milankovitch cycles. And they are sometimes, well, we'll see, some of these are used to calibrate the ice cores themselves. And I don't want to go into this in any great detail, but just to tell you that the eccentricity of the Earth's orbit changes these are exaggerated scales, but there are the values. With time, with periodicities, you see different periods up there, up to 495, 130 to 100,000 years. And at the moment, we are closest to the sun in January and furthest away from the sun in July. So we're closest to the sun in southern hemisphere winter. And precession, which just runs at about 26,000 years, so in 13,000 years' time, we will be closest to the sun in northern hemisphere summer and furthest away from the sun in southern hemisphere summer. So, and not only does this precession angle alter the time of year when we're closest to the sun, the angle itself varies by plus or minus 1.5 degrees or so. So these things, these subtle variations in parameters of the Earth's orbit seem to be enough to trigger the onset of ice ages. Very subtle effects, the differential heating of the Earth from pole to equator changes very slightly. There's another thing that wasn't discussed by Milankovitch, and that is the oscillation up and down about the invariable plane of the solar system, if you like, the theorem, the defining reference plane of with these periodicities. And it's thought that that might also play a role. And this diagram is just what's called a power spectrum. It just shows what I've said. We're in a 100,000-year period here and 40,000-year periods there, and they're related. So these subtle effects, these were subtle enough effects to trigger the onset of ice ages. Now, one thing that we are very fortunate to have is this very rich resource
now running back 800,000 years or so, of various measurements of sedimentary deposits from the sea, of ice core parameters, and various parameters from ice cores that give us clues about the recent climate. Now, one of the things they don't usually tell you is that let's look at those. Here are some ice cores here. There's a bloke sawing them up. They get these very long ice cores. The Vostok ice core, there it is, the details of it. It's warm at the top and cold at the bottom, basically. And you can see how dust correlates with the height of an ice age. The air gets more dusty. One of the things they don't tell you about this is that you can count annual rings in ice cores to give you a calibration, but actually beyond about 14,000 years, which is only kind of here, you lose that resolution of annual rings. So you have to use other parameters to give you your absolute calibration there. And don't ask me about it. That's not something I'm qualified to discuss. And just to show you our last ice age, and of course, just to set the scene for tomorrow, this from here to here was really the time of the emergence of modern human beings. So it all took place during the last ice age. And what we're looking at here is temperature derived from the Antarctic from two sites, and you'll see it's well correlated, and temperature derived from the Arctic, where you see much, much more structure. And this structure, so sort of kind of very short warm periods, and then cold periods. And this structure, we think, was certainly caused by changes in the ocean circulation going up into the Arctic latitude. So you can see the warming immediately after the end of the last ice age through to the present here. Okay, so that sets the scene. Now, if we want to look at climate change on a much shorter time scale, then we have to go back to our sun, and now we're going to have a period of looking at the sun and learning about what we know about the sun. Well, there's a picture of the sun, and what I like are fundamental observations that you can make very, very simply. With a pair of binoculars and a piece of cardboard, you can project an image of the sun, and the thing you will notice, and maybe you'll see some sunspots now, is that the sun looks darker at the edge than it is in the center. And that is a very fundamental observation, because that tells you the sun is a gaseous, slightly transparent sphere of gas. It looks as though it has a sharp edge, but you can see maybe 300 kilometers into the sun, below the surface. And if it was a solid body, it would be the same brightness all the way across. But it's not. It's a gaseous body. And so, you know, that you can deduce the sun is gaseous, is a gaseous sphere by looking at this picture. And why is that? Well, you always look to a constant sort of depth into the sun. You know, it's like flying in an aeroplane, seeing one of those fierce cumulus clouds, or thunderstorm clouds. From the distance it looked sharp-edged, but as you flew up to it in a plane, you wouldn't really know when you'd entered it. It would suddenly start getting foggy, and suddenly you wouldn't be able to see out of it. So you always see to a constant depth in the sun. If you look in the center, then you look physically deeper into the sun than if you look towards the edge. You can look the same number of kilometers, but you're not looking as deep, and so you are seeing to a slightly cooler region, because the sun gets hotter as you get to the inside. Now, that 300 kilometers, if there's the center of the sun, this is a segment, is actually thinner than this line here, which is why the sun appears to have a sharp edge, but nevertheless it changes. Now, if we look at the sun, and here's the sun, and we look at a thing of this scale, we will see that it is covered in these granules, about 1,000 kilometers in diameter. They are the heads of convection cells. When you boil up the water on the stove, you see how it wells up and goes down at the sides. Well, that's what the surface of the sun is like. And here's a little movie showing these convection cells. They move about 1,000 kilometres a second. This is highly speeded up. The gas wells up and then goes down the edges. So there we are. It's got convection cells. Now, they add together to make what we call superconvection cells. So you may think this is just the same convection cells you've been looking at. Now, this is important because it gives us an important way of studying the nature of the sun. This boiling makes a noise, a sound, a bit like the roar of a jet engine, if you like. And the sun is like a bell. It resonates at certain frequencies. And so if you have a roaring white noise, or by analogy a bell, and you start pouring handfuls of sand onto the rim of the bell will start to ring. So although the noise is random, the sun starts ringing at certain frequencies. And a series of telescopes, including one up at Sutherland, has been built to monitor the sun the entire day round. So there'll be some here, some in Australia, some in South America. So the sun oscillates. So why do we care about the sun oscillating? This shows one of the fundamental 5-minute period oscillations, greatly exaggerated, well, greatly speeded up, because it's a 5-minute oscillation. So there you are. So the sun is ringing like a bell, and that allows us to probe the interior of the sun. So this looks a bit complicated, but it's not really. Well, if you think of a ringing bell, what it is, it means that there are certain frequencies that fit exactly into, say, the circumference of the sun. So this might be a maximum, a maximum, a maximum, a maximum, all the way around, and it fits in, and then there's a one that's got less of these bumps that also fits in, and it's called L equals 2, that's called L equals 4. And because of the way density increases, if I was to bang the sun here, remember, imagine it's a bell, the wave would actually be refracted round, and it's all to do with the way the speed of sound varies. So that a frequency, a high frequency, only goes a shallow distance into the sun as it's refracted round and bounces off the surface. A low frequency goes a great distance into the sun. Now, that all sounds very easy, and there we are. But in fact, this is a frequency wavelength diagram, and I only show it to tell you there are about 7 million different oscillations there. Now, people much cleverer than me with powerful mathematics can take that distribution of frequencies, because there's not every possible frequency, all these empty spaces and places where there's no resonance, and they can invert that, and they can then probe the interior of the sun, and they can show where the sun is slightly hotter and slightly cooler than our models previously predicted. And we can see right inside the sun to see how it works. And this has been very, very important in trying to understand the nature of the sun. And this bit in here is the core, where the nuclear fusion reactions are taking place. And this shows, this is an overhot, this is a slightly cooler part of the core. This is compared with the model, not compared with some absolute sense. And this edge here is the point where the convection starts taking place, the bubbling that is making the noise that allows us to probe the sun. Now, this is one of those diagrams that comes out of a lecture for students. And what it is, it just shows the energy budget of the sun. Most of the energy coming from the core here takes neutrinos, take away 10% of the energy, photons from the surface, 90% of the energy, and a tiny, tiny, a thousand millionth of the energy is associated with magnetic fields. And right at the top, the mass loss. The mass loss is about 1,000 tons per second, although the sun is converting 1 million tons per second. The sun converts 4 million tons a second of mass into energy just to produce all the energy, but it actually loses about 1 million tons a second on average from its surface, and that is what we'll see as these coronal mass ejections. Okay, now what we are going to be particularly interested in, that tiny, tiny amount of energy that comes off, it's associated with magnetic fields, because they are responsible for sunspots. And sunspots, as you can see here in this speeded up rotation of the Earth, are cooler areas of the sun. That's why they're black. But they are regions of concentrated magnetic field. So this is just it shows you a series of sunspots rotating round. And we use special telescopes to observe sunspots. I think we've done enough of that. Let's move on. And this telescope here is built on the Palmer. It has a 1 meter diameter front lens, and it's a vacuum telescope, so the whole thing's held in a vacuum, and it is able to form images of the sun, and it is on a site. It has a big lens in order to achieve the high resolution that enables us to get sunspots images of this sort of quality. And these little dashes here are 1,000 kilometers or so, and possibly one of the highest resolution images ever obtained of these convection cells on the edge of this sunspot. There we are, the 1,000 kilometers, 1,000 kilometers, about that much there. And so I think here is a little movie that shows what is going on, and we see over a few hours, of course, the seeing the turbulence in the Earth's atmosphere is difficult, and we see what look like thin tubes. And this structure is all associated with the powerful magnetic field. So you can see the normal convection taking place up the top there. Now, I have to say that a lot of this we don't fully understand. This is just the justification to show that sunspots have strong magnetic fields, the splitting of the absorption lines. And this is an attempt to show the concentration of magnetic flux and the complicated mass motion, the material falling in there from high altitudes, pouring out at low altitudes, the magnetic field being swallowed up by the gas. Because when you have ionized gas with plasma, then the magnetic fields are sort of tied to the gas in a way they're not tied to a neutral gas. So it's like a kind of very dynamic, very complicated process. Now, interestingly enough, our ability to look at the oscillating sun has enabled us to look beneath a sunspot and see that the feature is surprisingly shallow, and that although the sunspot is cold, and there it is, cold with material coming down, below the sunspot there is an overheated region. And these arrows show how the gas circulates. Now, kind of what I'm doing is I'm telling you all about the sun, and I'm afraid there isn't a punchline for a lot of this. This is just the way it is. We're trying to understand it. So I'm just telling you all about it. Normally, and this is kind of building up to a grand sort of climax, but this is just telling you all about it. Sunspots come in pairs, and they have opposite magnetic fields. So if that's a north-south, then in the top it'll be south-north. Colour here indicates polarity. So if that's north-south pair, north-south pair, it'll be south-north, south-north, you know, lots of complicated. But the thing that is probably of most interest is the fact that the number of sunspots varies on an 11-year cycle. And this was the last cycle. In fact, we went through a very long and deep minimum, which may well have been one of the factors that influenced the Earth's climate. But you can see this is a prediction here. Here we are zooming up to the next solar maximum, 2011, 2012, around about 2013. So let us see how the activity of the sun varies during a solar cycle. You'll see the date nips up. This is an early one, 1996. And this is all done. These images are taken at very short wavelengths, down in towards the X-ray, far ultraviolet X-ray. And it shows, you will see how the activity increases, 1999, and then the year 2000. And you will see, and you will also see things that look like lines of force, magnetic fields. And you will see the effect that magnetic fields are clearly playing an important role on the surface of the sun, 2002, 2003. And you will see the occasional bursting flares. So I just want you to enjoy that, because the sun is pretty spectacular. There it goes. Okay. All right. There we are. That's enough. that. And there's another bit of phenomenology I suppose you ought to see, and that is the extraordinary what's called the butterfly diagram, that says at the start of the cycle, the sunspot pairs are always at high latitudes, and as the cycle goes on, they get nearer the equator, and at sunspot minimum, you see the old cycle decaying here, and the new cycle of sunspot pairs starting at higher latitudes, the butterfly diagram. I think we'll just briefly mention this one. You remember how it goes, well, this shows how the magnetic field of the sun alternates, this is at high latitude, goes from, say, North Pole to South Pole to North Pole. So the whole field of the sun flips over every 11 years. And I don't want to go on, this quantifies it, showing how the pairs of sunspots, that the leading sunspot is always nearer the equator, and if it has the south polarity, when this is the south pole, the north pole is trailing. And basically what we are seeing is a very complicated method where it is the magnetic field keeps reversing its cycle, reversing its direction, flipping the polarity of the sun from north to south pole. So we only get back to the same orientation of poles every 22 years. Now, fundamental to the whole production of sunspots is the fact that the sun does not rotate as a solid body. It goes around much faster at the equator than it does at the poles. 25 days to do one rotation at the equator, 28 days at the poles. The equatorial region is rotating faster than the solid body, the rest of the sun, and the polar region is rotating more slowly. And so I cannot explain to you how sunspots work. There is no simple explanation. People are building models, and not only mathematical models, but actually making huge spheres of liquid sodium that they're spinning at high speed to see if they can induce, if magnetic fields will be induced within these spheres. When you have a rotating conductor in astronomy, in the large-scale world, that conductor convect, where there can be flow within the conductor and it rotates, we induce magnetic fields. So the story has to be something like this. We start with north-south or south-north polar lines. Then they go up and down, but the differential rotation of the sun winds them up. So it goes from a polar to a toroidal magnetic field, something like that. The field is convected to the surface where it breaks through, and where it breaks through, it produces sunspots. As well as that is going on, there is what we call meridional circulation that has a period of 22 years that carries these spots up to higher latitudes, and then somehow the magnetic field lines reconnect in the opposite direction, and that is how the cycles go. It's not a satisfactory explanation. It's got to be something like that. People are trying to understand it. At sunspot minimum, the sun shows a beautiful dipole field, like iron filings on a piece of paper, sort of like that. At sunspot maximum, you get this very complicated situation. And in fact, this image comes from a total eclipse of 2001, which was visible in Zambia. But what was extraordinary, this guy, Mr. Fred Espinac, observes eclipses, and you can see the face of the moon in that eclipse from all those things. Now, I see we're, as usual, running out of time. So, I want to now talk about the importance of sunspots and their relationship to climate, and I want to tell you a bit more about the sun. The extraordinary thing about the sun is it gets cooler as you get to the surface, which is just what you'd expect, but then as you rise above the surface, the temperature gets hotter and hotter. The very surface is a mere 4,000 degrees, when we get up into the corona, we're nearly at a temperatures of a million degrees. Now, the density is very low, so that is not so important to us. But the question is, where does that energy come from? Now, the sun is continuously being monitored by this SOHO spacecraft. So that's where we're getting most of the images I'm going to show. So here we are, sun, 5,800 visible light. Now, if we go a bit above the surface, we go to some wavelengths, helium-2. We're now sampling gas above the surface at temperatures from 60 to 80,000 degrees. We look at even shorter wavelengths. We're looking at iron 9 to iron 10. This is iron with 8 outer electrons stripped off. We're sampling gas at about 1,000,000 degrees. And you can see the surface of the sun looks dark, but you can see a lot of that gas is associated with sunspots. And here we are at iron 25, 24 outer electrons stripped off. The surface of the sun is black because it's only 5,000 degrees and this is sampling 2 million degrees. But you can see regions associated with sunspots connected from one hemisphere to the other, and clearly that is where the heating is coming from. And here we are looking at the corona at temperatures of 1 to 5 million degrees. And this is in X-ray light. And here we see there's a comet going by, incidentally, and in the background you see the stars going by. This is one of the cameras on the SOHO spacecraft that is monitoring the material at temperatures of the order of 1,000,000 degrees, electrons streaming away from the surface of the sun. That's the diameter of the sun. This is a mask that blots the sun out. So if we're to understand the mechanism, then we have to perhaps look closer to the surface where we can see these flares, these typical sort of loops that are clearly following magnetic lines of force. And so that is one example in hydrogen alpha. And here is a fairly long sequence, but well worth looking at, in iron 12. And you will and when it glitches like that, that's because there were some missing observations. And you will see activity on the surface of the sun. You will see these bursts of activity. Now, once in a while, you will see the whole screen is covered in what look like scratches. And that is when one of these mass ejections actually comes towards the detector, towards the Earth, towards the SOHO satellite, which is about 1,000,000 miles between us and the sun, 1,000,000 miles away. And the protons slam through the detector and cause temporary damage to the detector. But it's just, I mean, even though we're going to be short of time, it's well worth, I think, watching this sequence of images. And you will see, you know, this was during 2003, during an active period of the sun, and you will occasionally see these little white scratches across the detector, but see how clearly we are looking at these magnetic field lines. There, you see, that burst, so there was a slight delay between the light, of course, travels much faster than the protons. Travels comes in 8 minutes, the protons take a few hours. Of course, this is highly speeded up, but you saw a great burst. Now, it just so happened that I had chosen to show some of my colleagues the surface of the sun through a telescope at Greenwich, and we had a special filter for H-alpha, and I just set it up during the time of one of these massive flares, and we did actually see, even in optical light, a brightening on the surface of the sun, which was, so for once in my life, I actually got to see something happen. My greatest disappointment was observing at Sutherland, being inside the dome, when a huge meteorite went overhead that lit up the land like daylight, and I was completely oblivious of it. But all my colleagues had seen it. So I got to see a massive solar flare. And here are examples of what we call coronal mass ejections. Just fun to show you. There's Mercury, that bright thing, and the stripe is because it's overexposed. When you see it flaring up all around you, that means that the on each side, that means the flare is coming towards you. And indeed, I thought I would just download this. Is it going to start? This is a contemporary. It comes to an end last night. This was the flare that we were all warned about that might cause GPS problems. Here we are, 25th, and it's 1806. So that was the data gathered last night for that particular flare. Okay, now I'm going to explain how a flare works, and what I want you to see is the 2 feet here and then the arch over the top.
There are two. This is the surface of the sun, the growing arch, the hot spot at the top there, and well, you can see 1 foot and a bit of another foot there. Very classic formation of a flare. 2 feet, material coming down, heating at the top there.
So again, something that
we only partially understand. What we have seen is how the magnetic fields from the sunspots loop up into space, and in fact they loop up, some of them close around, and some of them loop up and go right out into outer space. Now you can think of magnetic fields like elastic strings, they've got tension in them. And you can end up with what we call a geometrical problem, where the two magnetic fields that are looping up into space come together and then they touch, and then at that touch you get what's called a disconnection. The two bottom ones close up and the two top ones close up and move out. And when you start moving magnetic fields rapidly through ionized gas, you start inducing currents. So we release an enormous amount of energy at that point of disconnection. Electrons not only go spiraling out along the magnetic fields at high speed, but they stream down. The accelerated particles, which can be electrons and protons, collide with the surface, and where nuclear reactions take place, X-rays are released, more material then streams up and out into space. And that is the mechanism, that is the way we think the sunspots essentially connect with the outer space. And a good example of a flare is that one at the top where you see the kind of structure we saw in the diagram below. Now, here is some other evidence that now we are looking down on the flare at the surface of the sun, and so it looks like an arch there, but material has streamed down onto the surface like dropping a stone into a pond, and this is a Doppler diagram, so it's showing motion in the gas, as well as brightness, and you will see how these rings, this ring expands at 1,000 kilometers a second or so across the surface of the sun, where material has plunged back down into the surface of the sun. Just again, I mean, this is a wonderful excuse to show you some of the finest images that are being obtained from the surface of the sun by various experiments, not just SOHO, and I think this is particularly beautiful, this play of the magnetic fields associated with these flares. And you will you'll see some of these lines going right out into space. You'll see occasional puffs and fluffs going out. Let's just watch that. That is, I think that's particularly beautiful. It's extraordinary that we can study the sun, the surface of the sun, in such exquisite detail. And here is a particularly powerful flare that went off, actually it was last June, and you will see what is rather exciting, it keeps repeating itself, you will see material that is thrown off, and as it falls back, it is so dense that it looks black because it's cooler hydrogen that is absorbing the foreground light of the sun. And I think that is one of the most spectacular flares. I mean, a lot of material is puffed out into space. Of course, it doesn't always come towards us, which is a jolly good thing. But in this case, you see it blasted out and then falling back. And it's traveling at very, very high velocities. So this is, of course, speeded up. But the wonderful thing is that you can't see this detail, but there are telescopes that let you look at the sun in H-alpha light. And over a period of minutes, tens of minutes, you can see some of these flares changing their shape.
Okay, let's go on to that. I think maybe we won't bother with that. Let's move on. And here's just another coronal mass ejection. I think you'll see the Pleiades coming down. I probably, since we're a bit short of time, we should move on.
Now, what is the point? Well, the point is that material that is launched from the sun heads towards the Earth. And there we are, the photons take 8 minutes, and energetic particles, protons, high-energy protons, can come in hours, and the plasma may take 4 days to make its way from the sun
to the Earth. Now, the Earth is protected by its own magnetic field. So what happens when the plasma arrives? It buffets the magnetic field. It kind of shoves it, pushes it in the magnetosphere. And when you start buffeting and moving a magnetic field, you can start inducing currents on the ground. And that can be one of the dangers of these solar flares. They induce currents in pipelines and power lines, and they can, these DC currents can then burn out transformers and do all kinds of things like that. And what's more, the material can either make its way right round and come in and get down to the Earth near the poles. It can sort of come in through these neutral points where the field is turning one way and the other. It can make its way through there. And when it does, it strikes the above the atmosphere, it gets to the electrons spiraling down, collide with the air molecules, the nitrogen in the atmosphere, and cause it to fluoresce. And this is a picture of an aurora from one of the shuttle. And here is another picture of the aurora. You see the Earth down here, the surface of the Earth, and the aurora above you, seen from the space shuttle, and of course, more familiarly, from below at ground level. And I believe there was some spectacular aurora in the Arctic a couple of days ago. Now, back to sunspots. Now, the sunspot cycles vary in intensity with time. And in fact, we can now, we have been mapping sunspots back back to the beginning, to 1600, to the invention of the telescope. And we see how the strength of the cycles varies with time. One of the amazing things we discovered, and we've recently got more observations from Paris Observatory, during the 1650s, onwards, there was what was called the Maunder Minimum, a time when the sun appeared to show no sunspots at all. And the interesting thing about the Maunder Minimum was it was a time when it seemed certainly in Europe that it was referred to as the Little Ice Age, when the Thames froze over and things were cold. And back at the beginning of the 19th century, Sir William Herschel pointed out the results of a previous five periods of solar activity. It seems probable that some temporary scarcity or defect of vegetation has generally taken place when the sun has been without sunspots, basically. And he deduced this from looking at the price of wheat. Hence the connection between sunspots and Earth's climate. Now, again, so we start to run into the world of proxies. These are our sunspot observations. Going back to our Maunder Minimum here, here are some lengths of glaciers and so on. And here we have one of our proxies for solar activity, an excess of C14, and what people have identified as previous cold and warm periods. Now, many people have tried to make a connection between sunspot activity and climate, and it has proved very elusive, and in fact, I've never seen a diagram that purported to show this with any confidence, and the best thing I could find was a paper by this person here, Ilva Klavana, a PhD, in which he looked at porcupine feeding scars, which you could measure. There's a porcupine feeding scar, this is in Canada, and if you shift them by 5 years, you find that they correlate quite well with the solar maximum. So there was something, maybe porcupines took 5 years to grow up, and then they started munching the trees, and this goes back to the 1880s. Now, one of the problems, as we will see, is and here's another one. Here are very, very fine sediments laid down 680 million years ago in this formation in Australia. And they show periodicities that are very similar to some of the periodicities of the sunspot cycle. 23 years, our periodicity of the sunspot cycle is 22 years. Now, these fine valves, as they are said, are very fine sedimentary layers. And of course, this 680 million years ago was before when we still had single-celled organisms, before worms were around. Now, worms, in today's sediments, just mess it all up because they go and live in this stuff, so you can't see it. Now, I have to say that one of the problems that is arising with this whole business of sunspots is there are natural periodicities in the Earth's atmosphere that we don't yet understand that may be close to some of these cycles. So if we were to say, how can sunspots affect the sun? Well, we know that the amount of radiation that comes out during sunspot maximum is greater than at sunspot minimum. We measure that radiation, it's called the solar irradiance, and but it's a tiny, tiny fraction of a percent, so it couldn't possibly make any difference to the Earth's atmosphere. It could, however, alter the ultraviolet flux, and it is thought that perhaps that is the way it does it. There is a correlation between the sunspot cycle and the number of cosmic rays that arrive on Earth. So it has been suggested that cosmic rays somehow affect the Earth's climate. In fact, it's been suggested that the cosmic rays, when they come down to the surface, we know they produce many millions of particles that provide nuclei for cloud formation. This is a highly controversial thing. In fact, experiments are being done at CERN to sort of demonstrate this effect. But it's again, it doesn't seem to fit together properly. So let us just be empiricists. Let us just look at temperature and see what it correlates with. Now, the problem of the black line here are the temperatures that we measured with our thermometer. If we want to go back in time, and this is 2000, this is the year naught, we have to use all kinds of proxies, and you can see they don't fit together. There's a heck of a lot of dispersion there, but you can see it's maybe warmer there and cooler down here. These are measures of temperature. And then, what do? We look at temperature. There's temperature, a nice smooth curve fitted to it. And there on the background, and you can see another nice smooth curve fitted to all this messy data of a proxy for solar activity, namely the carbon isotope number. You have to correct that for the age effect and so on. So it looks as though there is a correlation. The two curves fit more or less a bit there. They seem to diverge there, but we can just ignore that. And so it looks as though... Now, we can measure... So what do we say? We can measure cosmic ray activity back for... And I'm sorry, the scale's gone off the bottom there, which is very naughty, but going back for 10,000 years... That's, should have shrunk these, 10,000 years or so. Oh, yeah, there it is, there's the scale. 10,000 years. And there is the recent data, and the red are the sunspots, so you can see where the two systems overlap, and we can't correlate it up to the present because the observations are contaminated by the results of nuclear activity. So, weapons testing. So, if we go back about 9,000 years, we see that there was... a period that may have of more intense cosmic ray activity, and it is suggested, and this is solar activity, it's not temperature, that we are at the moment living through a period of strong solar activity, maybe not seen for the last 10,000 years. And so we might say, what is the evidence? So we come back now to our world temperature thing, and we are comparing it with solar activity. These are sunspot cycles now. And you would say, well, yeah, that's not a bad correlation. You can see it's going down and then it goes up a bit. And so, yeah, so if we want to say the sun and the climate are linked together, then we just don't bother with anything since 1960. But let's put in the rest of the graph, and what do we see? Oh dear. Instead of this curve going up, it's gone down. And so what you might conclude, the most optimistic thing you might conclude, is that the sun did indeed play an important role on the short time scale in climate, maybe up to the 1960s, and then things perhaps have changed. But now, gosh, I really have to race through this. Let's just look at carbon dioxide on its own. Here is carbon dioxide measures for the last 600,000 years in and out of ice ages. Here from 1750 up to 2008. We are in territory we have not been in for 600,000 years, maybe even for 20 million years. So what do the climate models tell us? Well, here the red are the world temperatures, the model simulations are green, and if we just include the sun and volcanoes, well, it goes pretty well up to just the 1960s, but then the two diverge. In order to make them fit, we have to put the carbon dioxide back into the story. And so maybe the simplest way, and there are the detailed carbon dioxide, so here we've got carbon dioxide with the annual variation solar activity. So perhaps, I mean, something that you want to do is to plot temperature, and 1 degree is between the white things, against carbon dioxide. And you will see that there is a general increase, but you will also notice for the last 10 years or so, there has been a levelling out at the top. It's interesting to see how this graph is like a concertina, opens up as carbon dioxide increases and increases and pulls it up, and I put some markers on it. So you might say, well, it's not entirely clear what is going on, because CO2 has certainly been increasing in the last 10 years, but temperature seems to have come possibly to a temporary halt. Now, what the climate change people tell us we should do, and I've got to race through this a bit, is we should not look at average temperatures, we should look at global temperatures. And what we are doing here is we're back in 1905, we're coming up, we are comparing the temperature all over the Earth with an average value struck from 1950 to 1980. So we're in 1929, gosh, look, this very hot period in the 1930s in Central Africa there. And where it's red, it's hotter than the average, and where it's cool, where it's blue, it's cooler than the average. We're up to 1956, so we're into the period where we're taking the average, so to think that the colours disappear because they're equal to the average. But as we get up to 1980, we are now beyond, we were in the more recent time, and you will notice it is getting warmer in the southern hemisphere around here, in the Antarctic Peninsula, it is colder here. You'll see how it gets warmer up there, 2007. So you will see that in general, the climate, that you see behind this, that there are regions where there is particular warming, and that warming correlates for quite a long time. Now I'm going to pass over that. That just tells you the temperature hasn't changed much in the last 10 years. Now, what I want to say is that in the last few years, we were at the bottom of a solar minimum. The solar minimum was longer than we'd seen for a long time. It looks as though solar activity was declining. And what we are looking at here is something that some of you may remember. December to January, February 2010 was particularly cold in North America and in Europe and over there to sort of central Russia. And we experienced an anomalously cold winter, and this was thought to be due to the lower solar activity. But notice, the rest of the world, and particularly the Arctic, was well in trend with the normal climate change. In the following year, 2010-2011, we experienced a similar very cold winter in Europe and North America. A lot of people said, no, climate change is gone, it isn't there. But look, take the world as a whole, we see that general trend was still there. And it is now thought that it is possible that those effects with sunspots are in fact, in some subtle way, altering the way the jet streams operate over North America and Europe, and that is the effect that gives us particularly cold conditions during a sunspot minimum. Now, you might say, how is it that temperature can stay constant for 10 years when CO2 is rising? Well, it can arise because there are a lot of natural oscillations in the Earth's atmosphere that we do not fully understand, where we go from hot to cold to hot to cold periods. This thing, the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, is just one that's been picked out. And there are natural frequencies in the Earth's climate that are very similar in length to the sunspot cycle and cannot yet be reproduced by sunspot by climate models. Now, I want to just bring this to a rapid conclusion. We can look at this tomorrow, but that just says there are lots of things that affect climate on different timescales. So I just want to summarize. Do I have any reservations about the whole story of climate change? Yes, I do. The Earth's climate is very complex. We do not yet know all the to understand all the inputs. I'm not convinced that we quite understand the sensitivity of temperature to carbon dioxide, which was the slope of that carbon dioxide thing when we change it. The slope varies. Is the build-up of CO2 preventing a new ice age? Well, I really don't know. Maybe it is. So I think the final conclusion, the Earth's climate has changed dramatically in the past and will do so without any effect of us in the future. And there are many effects. CO2 concentration, this is a serious warning, is higher than any time in the last 500,000 years, perhaps in the last 20 million years. Human activity is definitely responsible for that. The problem is, by the time we can be 99% certain about the effect of CO2 on climate, it'll be too late to do it. Okay, and I think the important thing is to strike the right balance between adaption to change and prevention. Okay, sorry to overrun. I think...